Good morning. Welcome to the press briefing of the UN here in Geneva. Today is Friday, 5th of September, and we are going to start by focusing immediately on the situation of the floods in Pakistan. For that, we have the pleasure to have with us the head of delegation of the IFRC in Pakistan, connecting from Islamabad. It's not on your agenda, but there will also be Claire Newlis for WMO, talking about the meteorological aspects of the floods. But I would like to start with the words of the Secretary General, who on the 3rd of September, just after the floods, has put out a statement through his spokesman where he said that he is profoundly saddened by the recent floods in northern Pakistan, which have reportedly claimed more than 400 lives. I guess maybe Mr. Abdul Qadir will give us an updated figure. The Secretary General commends Pakistani authorities for relocating more than 1 million people in Punjab. He expressed the solidarity, his solidarity with the government and people of Pakistan, extended his heartfelt condolences to the families of those who have lost their lives, and wished a swift recovery to those who have been injured. He also said that the United Nations and its partners are working closely with Pakistani authorities to rapidly assess the humanitarian impact of the floods, identify needs and address gaps in the response to the disaster. And has been also a contribution by the Emergency Relief Fund, who has been released by Tom Fletcher, our Emergency Relief Coordinator. And this money goes to support relief and recovery efforts, while discussions are underway with the government on a response plan. And you have the complete statement in your mailboxes. So this is what I had on the side of the Secretary General. And I'd like to go straight to Islamabad now to listen to what Mr. Farid Abdul Qadir, as I said, IFRC head of delegation in Pakistan, has to tell us. And then we will listen from Claire from WMO. Sir, you have the floor.
Thank you very much. Good morning from your end and good afternoon from our side. As you are aware, Pakistan has been experiencing monsoon rains that started somewhere between June, July, with escalation mainly in August. And at this moment, we are also seeing even drastic escalation. Far over 1 million plus people have been directly affected, and almost 2 million plus have been indirectly affected. Water has been, by yesterday, the figures that were provided were almost 884 people that have been killed by the floods. The figures are huge. However, the most affected region is Punjab province, which is actually host to half of the 250 million population of Pakistan. This death could have been more. Advanced measures were taken to warn the population along the river basin, and information was relayed to the communities through the government of Pakistan and the Pakistani Red Crescent and various other organizations that are working and supporting in community disaster risk measures. There are also colleagues of ours that have were deployed to support with the advanced preparation through what we call the anticipatory action protocol. So a lot was done. And even as we speak, water has hit Punjab, but it's on its way down to Sindh province, and already advanced preparations are done and communities have been mobilized to avert and hopefully reduce the risks downstream. The rains are not just is falling within the region, but also are being fueled by water coming downstream. And it's in huge quantities and destabilizing and increasing the risks as the rains falls also on our end. The Pakistani Red Crescent has deployed teams to support, but however, as you know, our structures are that we have local teams. So literally in all communities affected, you also have branches of the Pakistani Red Crescent who are currently providing both dry ration, food ration. They are providing both clinical health through mobilization of the mobile health team that are actually supported by the Norwegian Red Cross, We have water systems that have been dispatched to the ground that are able to purify 12,000 liters of water per day, per unit, and there are almost eight. Some already been set up and some are on the way down. You have almost 1,000 staff and volunteers amounting almost to 20,000 that are already activated and active on the field. However, the areas affected is huge. The number of people affected keep on increasing. And of course, these floods are both immediate impact, but also long-term impact in terms of food production. These are the same communities that have been affected by the COVID phenomenon that was there just a couple of, the epidemic was endemic that was there just a couple of years ago. And there've also been floods almost on daily, every year between or during the monsoon period. Some of these have been attributed to climate change. As you know, out of the worst polluted area or cities, the 10, 8 are coming from Asia Pacific area, while two of the worst affected or the worst polluted cities are in Pakistan. So although Pakistan has drastically been hit by climate change, it is one of the least emission countries that emits climate change. So both this has a various factors that have contributed to the increase in vulnerability of the community. We have launched an appeal for 17 million. So far, the response has been very poor. We've already dispatched, or the Federation has already dispatched 1 million CHF as part of the DREF Emergency Fund. And we are mobilizing colleagues within the Red Cross, Red Crescent movement to support. So we already have colleagues from the German Red Cross, Norwegian Red Cross, Turkish Red Crescent, Canadian, British Red Cross that are part of the efforts on the ground. And we hope more will join in. Already the Australian Red Cross is showing, mobilizing its resources. So we are trying as International Federation to mobilize our membership globally to be able to support the efforts of Pakistani Red Crescent to respond to the current crisis. I will end there and we'll welcome any comment or questions that.
Mr. Dulkadir, could I ask you please to repeat the figures that you said at the beginning? Because unfortunately at the beginning, the sound was coming quite broken. And just the first part of your presentation, there were some figures about the number of casualties and we couldn't hear that part. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. I mean, so far, the number of deaths as of 5th of September is 884 that have been killed. And they have occurred in various districts. There are seven districts that are affected, including also Islamabad. You know, the total population of people that have been displaced is almost 1 million. And the people affected would be close to almost 2 million people. The number of people that have been evacuated by the government is almost 1 million people. And based on statistics we have right now, almost 9,363 houses have either been partially or fully destroyed. The livestock that have been killed so far, the figures given are 6,180. But all this is based on figures available at the moment because the situation is dynamic and keeps on changing, considering the water is flowing downstream, but also the continuation of the rains and water for, coming downstream.
Thank you very much, sir, for repeating this. I have a question in the chat. Could you please tell us what is the source of those data? Especially the number of casualties.
First, we have Red Cross, the Pakistani Red Crescent people in the field, and this would be the same data that will be available. So we're quoting figures that are also with the government of Pakistan and also with the organizations that are operating in the region.
Thank you. Journalists are asking whether it is possible to have your notes distributed. I don't know if you can help us. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, thanks very much. Good morning, everyone. I'm Scott Craig from IFRC. Nice to see you. Yes, we will send a copy of Fareed's briefing note out after this that contains all of those figures he referenced as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thanks for this update. Of course, these figures are the latest, and what I read in the statement of the Secretary General is from a couple of days ago. So we'll thank you for those updated figures. So before I open the floor to question, I'd like to give the floor to Claire for WMO to hear a little bit more about the flooding. Claire?
Yes, so good morning, everybody, and thank you for inviting me at short notice. So just to complement what our colleagues from the IFRC have just said, unfortunately, there's no immediate respite in sight. The Pakistan Meteorological Department has latest forecast talks about a low pressure system, which is currently in India, which is likely to move west-northwest and bring strong monsoon currents to Sindh and the eastern parts of Punjab from the 6th of September, so from tomorrow onwards. I've put the link in the chat to you of the latest forecast, but basically in a nutshell, it says that heavy rains may generate flash floods in streams, and then there's a very long list of places, Kashmir, Islamabad, Rawalpindi, northeast Punjab, Swat, and so the list goes on. You will have all the names in the link I put in the chat. It says heavy downpour may cause urban flooding. So flash floods are different from urban floods. Flash floods are, you know, what we see. They strike communities unaware. They sort of roar down hillsides, and they're very, very devastating, very, very deadly. Urban floods, it's a slightly more slow-moving process, but, you know, equally devastating. So the Pakistan Meteorological Department is warning of urban floods in low-lying areas of Islamabad, Rawalpindi, Lahore, Faisalabad, Peshawar, and other places. It's also warning of landslides, mudslides, which may cause road closure in vulnerable hilly areas. And again, you know, Kiba, Pakhtunkhwa, Gilgit, Baltistan, and Kashmir, other areas. So it's a continuation, unfortunately, of what we've been seeing for the past few weeks. We've seen absolutely devastating landslides, mudslides in Pakistan, also in the mountainous regions of India, which of course very heavy loss of life. And compounding the rainfall situation is the fact that high temperatures are causing glacier melt. So the Pakistan Meteorological Department again has this summer issued repeated warnings about what we call glacial lake outburst floods. So it's basically, you know, when a glacier melts and it floods over. Now the most recent alert about this was on the 30th of August, when the Pakistan Meteorological Department said there was much higher than normal temperatures, which may accelerate glacier melt, and it gave a long list of areas which might be impacted by this. And as we said, you know, this situation has been continuing now for the past few weeks. It's not new. Unfortunately, every year Pakistan does suffer from bad flooding. We can all remember back to 2022 when nearly 1,700 people lost their lives from flooding. And this year it looks to be bad again. And just general background, yes, it is the monsoon season. Climate change obviously does play a big role because according to the law of physics, for every additional degree Celsius of temperature increase, the atmosphere holds about 7% more water. So when it rains harder and there'll be more floods. So thanks. And at the same time, you know, there's the risk of more glacial outburst floods.
Thank you very much, Claire. That was a very useful update. Let me open the floor to questions now. I see Jeremy Lange, Radio France Internationale.
Thank you. Claire, you mentioned... Can you hear me? Yeah.
Claire, you mentioned the 2002 floodings, and we're not there yet in terms of casualties, but of course it reminds us of what happened back then. I'd like to know if Pakistan is or was better prepared this time. We remember that there was a conference here in Geneva with, I think, $9 billion US dollars that was promised for Pakistan to face that kind of flooding. So do we know if the money actually got to Pakistan? And yeah, bottom line is, was the country better prepared this time or not?
Claire?
I think our IFRC delegation chief on the ground is better placed to answer that, because he talked about anticipatory action, which is a bit of a buzzword in the humanitarian community, but it basically means if you've got the forecasts of bad weather, of heavy rainfall, you take action in advance. You pre-position your food stocks, your shelter supplies, evacuate people, and that saves lives and livelihoods. But I think IFRC is much, much better at explaining that than me.
Maybe Mr. Abdulkadir.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you very much. I think it's a very good question. I cannot speak about the money that was pledged or where it went, but I can tell you for sure that before the rain started, the communities were mobilized, people were warned. There has been activities including looking at floods mitigation measures, like trying to clear the pathways for water. So there was a lot that was done. Now, if you look at the worst affected province, which is Punjab, it has half of the population of 250 million. If you look at the quantities of water and all, the number of 840 is not small, but it could have been higher. So a lot of work was done to evacuate, to warn, and I think some of the officials that were responsible for that, some even had to be released of their duty because of ensuring or not ensuring that strict measures were taken. So a lot, I can tell you, a lot was done. And there has been working groups or groups of communities that have been mobilized, communities that are involved in the preparation for the flood season. Unfortunately, a lot of time is used to, of course, prepare for disasters. This could have been time used to prepare for food production and planting of seeds. But that was done. If that was not done, the preparation and evacuation was not in advance, then the number of people who are dead could have been huge. I know there has been past disasters, there have been past floods. This is not small, and don't underestimate the power of nature. I mean, the water, the flood water, but in huge quantities and at forces that are at times quite huge. And also looking at trends, global trends, there have been similar events that have occurred in West, in Europe, in Americas. And when it does, it causes a lot of destruction, despite the level of preparedness resources that are put into the system. So I can confidently tell you a lot was done before, because as said, the floods in Pakistan are predictable. You can actually... from the monsoon period, the peak is around mid of August, so it's really predictable, and the teams did all they could to prepare, but the magnitude and complexity of these floods were quite huge. I hope I've answered the question.
I'm looking at Jeremy. Is that okay? Okay. Other questions in the room? Nina, I had seen your head. Is that... No? It's okay? If there are no other questions in the room, let me go to the platform. First of all, Mr. Abdulkadir, sorry, one the journalist from Associated Press was asking about the figures. He's also asking what is this, the time span for these casualties. I guess it's from the moment of the flooding, the start of the flooding.
Yes, it is from June up to 5th of September. So when the monsoon season started, it's cumulative figures.
Okay, thank you very much. Ravikant?
Yeah, thank you. My question is to Claire. You said two things, one extreme heat as well as excess activity or overactivity in melting of the glaciers. Are you referring to the Himalayan glaciers here? And also, is it largely an overflow of the Indus Valley waters, Indus rivers waters into Pakistan?
There's multiple factors. I mean, in terms of glaciers, it's a very widespread general phenomenon. Pakistan monitors the glacial outburst floods very, very closely. It has a special monitoring system for it. Pakistan is not the only country that suffers from these glacial-related flooding. There was a very bad flood on the border between China and Nepal a couple of months ago. So this unfortunately is a phenomenon that we're seeing in the Himalayas, in other, high mountain ranges as well, and it's a phenomenon which will continue. In terms of the flows from the Indus rivers, I'm not an expert on geography, but I can put in the chat, I did see a map from the Pakistan Meteorological Department, which sort of highlights the extreme flood risk areas. So I'll locate that and I'll put it in the chat to you. I think that's the best. But maybe IFRC can help on that.
Thank you very much, Claire. Let me see if there are other questions. Mr. Abdulkadir, would you like to add something? I don't see other questions for you. But if you want to add something, sir, please.
Yeah, if I got the question right, the areas affected are mainly community living along the river basin.
Sorry, sir, you're coming all broken again. Can you hear me? You're blocked.
She's the capital city.
Mr. Abdulkadir, sorry. We couldn't hear a word of what you just said. I don't know if you can repeat, please.
Okay. I said most of the areas, the worst affected area is the Punjab province. And Punjab province is actually the most populated province. It holds half of the 250 million population of Pakistan. And the other areas, all the other provinces are affected, and especially downstream where Sindh province, and most of the water that is now being experienced in Punjab is going downstream towards Sindh province. So already the volunteers and the government are preparing themselves on the other side, on that end, so that we avert and reduce or minimize and hopefully eradicate any risks of loss of life. But literally all the seven provinces are affected. And as I said, it's both rain falling within Pakistan, but also water coming downstream.
Thank you so very much, sir. I think this concludes the questions. Thanks a lot to Claire for chiming in with this important compliment. And if you could send the notes to all the journalists, that would be really appreciated.
Sure, we'll send it out straight after this. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you very much. Mr. Abdulkadir, thank you very much for being with us today. Don't hesitate to come back when you have updates on the situation in Pakistan. Thanks again. So let me now go to my left, in fact, right, left. Ravina is with us. Ravina, you have an update on the situation of human rights in DRC. You have a report, in fact.
We do. Good morning, everyone. You should have received the report already in English and in French alongside the the press release. It makes for very difficult reading, and I do encourage you to read the report in its entirety. The Human Rights Council in February this year asked our office to establish a fact-finding mission on the escalation of hostilities in North and South Kivu provinces of the DRC. Our report today covers the period between January and July of 2025 this year. The FFM's work is also intended to serve as a foundation for the commission of inquiry that was mandated by the same resolution of the Human Rights Council to in turn conduct comprehensive investigations into events since 2022. The report finds that gross human rights violations and violations of international humanitarian law have been committed by all parties to the conflict, by the M23, supported by the Rwanda Defense Forces, as well as by the Congolese Armed Forces and affiliated armed groups. The M23 armed groups, with training, material, intelligence, and operational support from the Rwandan Defense Forces, captured major cities in North and South Kivu. The group engaged in a campaign of intimidation and violent repression through a recurrent pattern of summary executions, torture, detention, and forced disappearances, and forced recruitment targeting anyone perceived as opposing the M23, regarded as a threat to its notion of order and security, or deemed fit to fight or serve the movement. M23 members also systematically carried out widespread sexual violence, including gang rape and sexual slavery. Women and girls were disproportionately targeted, but men, boys, and LGBT individuals were also victims of sexual violence, including in detention. Hundreds of children were detained by M23, and young males were forcibly recruited. The report exposes the enormous toll of the conflict on children of all ages. Daily violations across the entirety of the territory under the M23's control followed discernible, recurring patterns indicating a high degree of organization, planning, and resource mobilization. We have reasonable grounds to believe that the M23 members may have committed the crimes against humanity of murder, severe deprivation of liberty, torture, rape, and sexual slavery, and forced disappearance and deportation or forcible transfer of population. The report also documents grave violations committed by the DRC armed forces and affiliated groups, such as the Wazalendo, including deliberate killings of civilians. It identifies a pattern of widespread use of sexual violence by them as well, mainly gang rape and rape against women and girls, and looting by members of the FARDC and Wazalendo during their retreat from the front lines in January and February. Perpetrators operated in large groups and in multiple localities simultaneously. Wazalendo armed groups also recruited children under the age of 15 and used them in hostilities. The children were used in combat and in support roles, with girls also used for sexual purposes. The report finds that both DRC and Rwanda bear responsibility for their support to armed groups with known track records of serious abuses and for failing to meet their obligations to take all measures to ensure respect for international humanitarian law and to protect civilians from harm. Specifically, the report stresses that Rwanda is responsible for violations directly committed by its armed forces on the territory of the DRC. We have received credible allegations concerning the covert presence of RDF personnel within the M23. The report also states that the DRC bears responsibility not only for the violations committed by its armed forces, but also by its affiliated armed groups, to the extent that their members acted under its direction or control. Our findings underscore the gravity and widespread nature of violations and abuses committed by all parties to the conflict, including acts that may constitute war crimes and crimes against humanity. The report highlights the lack of focus on accountability and support for victims in the peace agreement that was signed between the DRC and Rwanda on the 27th of June. The atrocities described in this report are horrific. It is heartbreaking and deeply frustrating to witness once again the dehumanization of the civilian population by those in power who are failing in their responsibilities. It is imperative to promptly and independently investigate all violations, all allegations of violations, with a view to ensuring accountability and victims' rights to truth, justice, and reparations, and especially guarantees of non-repetition.
Truly a hard reading, huh? Really. Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, so let's open the floor to questions. Jeremy was first, sorry, and Nina.
Hi, Ravina. Just to make sure I get that right. Yeah, right there. You mentioned specifically crimes against humanity that were committed by M23 forces. You also mentioned that every party committed violations of human rights. I'd like to understand, to make sure that I get that right. Crimes against humanity by M23, do the Congolese forces also committed crimes against humanity, or only war crimes? I want to make sure that I understand correctly. And also, we know that there have been an agreement that was signed in Washington, but to your knowledge, do those crimes are still ongoing in the east of DRC as we speak? Thank you.
Thank you. Indeed, we have, on the basis of the information that we've been able to gather, as I said, the crimes against humanity, we do have reasonable grounds to believe that the M23 members may have committed the crimes against humanity of murder, severe deprivation of liberty, torture, rape, and sexual slavery, enforced disappearance, and the deportation or forcible transfer of population. Now, while the report does not find crimes against humanity, it does not find that the threshold of crimes against humanity is easily met based on the evidence that we have managed to gather with regards to the FARDC, with the armed forces of the DRC. This does not take away from the seriousness of the issue. We have only been able to come to these determinations based on the information we've been able to gather in this very short period of time. So it does not take away from the seriousness of the violations that have been committed. The scale, the geographic spread, the number of victims, the repetitive nature of these crimes are very serious. And there are structural problems that have existed in the DRC for a very long time that have been neglected. The serious impunity with which these groups have been operating in the past have also been neglected. And these are things that need to be addressed as soon as possible. On the peace deal, I'm sorry, I missed your question there exactly.
It's still happening now that we are talking, while we are talking. I mean, this is something that happened also after.
So what we have unfortunately seen after the signing of the peace deal is a continuation of violations. In fact, I believe at the noon briefing just on Wednesday this week, the Secretary General's spokesperson highlighted the continuing commission of violations, particularly in South Kivu, and the continued commission also of sexual violence. I think one important thing that he highlighted too was the lack of support services for victims of sexual violence due to the lack of funding for these support services. So, you know, sexual violence has always been very difficult to document everywhere in any conflict, and this is particularly the case in the DRC because of the stigma to which the victims of sexual violence are subjected. But now we're also facing a situation where they don't even have access to the meager support services that they used to get. So there are no kits, for example, available to them in medical centers. And these are the kinds of places where we would go as well to try to document the scale of the sexual violence that has been perpetrated. In the report, you'll also see that the M23 has been targeting human rights defenders and civil society organizations. And again, these are people who would normally provide support and services to victims, but they themselves are being targeted.
Yeah, and maybe I just sorry, I would just add in reference to what Ravina said, that is indeed on Wednesday that Stéphane Dujarric read this at the noon briefing, and I think it's important to answer your question, Jeremy. He said, meanwhile, on what is going on, so now in the eastern part of the DRC, our humanitarian colleagues say that continued violence in the eastern province of South Kivu continues to claim civilian lives and drive new displacement. In the northern part of the province, in Kalehe territory, our partners on the ground report that clashes between armed groups persisted as recently as yesterday, so that would be Tuesday. According to local sources, at least 22 women were raped during armed clashes in several villages in the territory between 22nd and 31st August, just where we are speaking almost. Our local partner report that victims did not receive medical care, which was what you were saying, no assistance, within the critical 72-hour period following the incidents, amid shortages of resources, including medical supplies and security constraints. Sadly, due to recent funding cuts, more than half of the gender-based violence services have been suspended across the country. The violence also forced nearly 23,000 human beings to flee their homes, which is in addition to the more than 128,000 people who have already been displaced in this province between May and August. In this territory, we and our humanitarian partners are providing nutrition support, healthcare, and assistance in agricultural recovery. Then he continues with other figures in the neighboring territory of Walungu. And I like I can send you all the figures if you want. But the one thing I wanted to underline is that the 2025 humanitarian response plan, which seeks $2.5 billion to assist 11 million people, is currently funded at less than 15%. With only 376 million received up to Wednesday, basically. This shortage in funding severely limits our ability to reach all the people who are in desperate need.
Alessandra, if I could just add, this is the paragraph I was looking for in the report, paragraph 78, if you want clarity on the qualification of crimes in relation to the FARDC, the armed forces of the DRC, please refer to paragraph 78, where it's explained quite well.
Thank you. I saw Buddy and then Nina.
Well, I have a question on another topic.
In this case, let's continue with the ERCs, please. And I won't forget it, but maybe I'll give the floor to Nina now.
Yeah, thanks, Ravina. I was wondering what kind of response you've received from the DRC after this. I assume you've submitted it to them and also to Rwanda, given that the DRC was also the one who asked for the session creating the fact-finding mission. And then when it comes to the Commission of Inquiry that has yet to be constituted, could you sort of say what the impact will be if this fact-finding mission now ends its work and there's nothing to take its place? Thank you.
Thanks, Nina. Yes, we did receive responses from both the DRC authorities as well as the Rwandan authorities. On the details of those responses, of course, I would ask you to contact them directly, and on whether these responses can be published or not as well. That would be something to be determined. But we did receive responses from both of them. And we did receive access. So the fact-finding mission did conduct missions to the DRC, to Rwanda, and to Burundi, in fact. And we do thank the governments for their facilitation of these missions and for their cooperation. Regrettably, we did not get access to refugee sites in Uganda, and the FFM were also denied access to Goma by the M23's leadership, and we could therefore not visit the areas controlled by the M23. On the Commission of Inquiry, I think the findings of this report drive home just how serious the situation is. We were all following it, but the extent, the scope, the scale of the violations, the degree of just systematic conduct of these violations, the complete impunity, what I've read out only highlights some of the elements in this report. But of course, you're also aware of the jailbreaks of perpetrators of very serious violations of human rights and international humanitarian law as well, who are on the loose. This report should drive home the importance of accountability and justice for these violations. It is crucial that the Commission of Inquiry is adequately funded and is able to carry out its mandate.
Laurent?
Yeah, thank you, Ravina. Kind of follow up to that, because it was the decision to postpone the formal launch of the COI was part of the measures that were decided by the High Commissioner because of the liquidity crisis. So could you explain a little bit more why this particular one, which is the only country situation that was a part of that package, why he decided a few months ago to postpone that one? And does he regret now, given the scope and the importance of the violations that are underlined, to have taken that decision? And then lastly, has the FFM compiled a list of potential individual perpetrators, or has it planned to let that task to the potential future COI? Thank you.
Thanks for your question, Laurent. In fact, it's an opportunity to clarify some things. The office was mandated by the Human Rights Council to carry out these tasks, these very crucial tasks, to try to document exactly what happened. And particularly in these conflict situations, as you know, the facts are among the biggest casualties, right? You have propaganda from all sides. So it is crucial that we as the UN Human Rights Office are able to objectively assess what exactly happened, what the violations were, what they amount to, what attribution of responsibility where possible as well. We were given this very important mandate, but we were not given the funding to discharge this mandate. In fact, you have seen the High Commissioner has spoken about what a dire funding situation we're in. We're having to cut our presences. We're having to cut the contracts of staff as well. In spite of this situation, we carried out the work of the fact-finding mission. And you have seen the results of this work. We have tried to spotlight just how dangerous and difficult the situation has been and remains in the country. So it is crucial that the Commission of Inquiry that was mandated by member states is also adequately funded by member states to be able to do its work properly, to try to advance the cause of justice and prevention of further gross human rights violations in the country. On the names, yes, the fact-finding mission did receive some names of, you know, individuals or contingents that are responsible. It's keeping those names for now, and we'll determine further what to do with them in, as the situation evolves, if there is a commission of inquiry that is adequately funded. And you might be aware that the ICC, the International Criminal Court, is also engaged on the situation in the DRC.
Ravi, is that on DRC?
No, my question is not about DRC.
Okay, let me see if there are other questions about these reports in the room or online. No? Okay, so Ravi, ask your question, then I'll go to Bodhi.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. Ravina, I'm touching on India. There is this, very disturbing case of incarceration of several people under some kind of absurd charges of Delhi riots. The person whom I'm particularly mentioning is Umar Khalid, one of the finest scholars. Does HRC have anything to say on this ongoing incarceration of young students who were protesting about what was called the CAA, that is Citizen Amendment Act? Would you have anything to say on this?
On the Citizenship Amendment Act, yes, we have spoken about this. But on the specific case, Ravi, let me check with my colleagues and get back to you how closely they've been following it and if there's anything that we can say on it. I'll get back to you.
Bodhi?
Yeah, my question on United States. Since United States announced who has not participated UPR review, so what kind of procedure or politic consequence may they have? And does Commissioner have any comments on this case or follow-up planned on this follow-up? Thank you.
Thanks, Bodhi. On the U.S.'s announced decision, of course, we are aware and we regret the decision of the U.S. Not to engage with this very important peer review process. I mean, you as journalists who are based here understand that this is a universal periodic review that all member states participate in. And whether you're a member of the council or not a member of the council, you participate in this process. Constructive engagement with the Council by the U.S. and all states has contributed to the promotion and protection of human rights worldwide over the years. On our part, our office and the High Commissioner will continue to engage with the government of the United States, as well as civil society, academia, businesses, and others on human rights issues.
If the High Commissioner, yeah.
And you're also from the Commissioner.
Okay, go ahead. You wanted to know if the High Commissioner.
Oh, of course, no, I speak for the High Commissioner. So the High Commissioner is concerned. He is aware of the decision, and he regrets the decision of the U.S. not to engage with this important intergovernmental peer review process.
Nina?
I wanted to ask you about another issue. It's about the strike on the boat off of Venezuela, which has been accused of, Venezuela has said that this was that these were summary executions or of people. I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that. And also, I mean, given your office's constant reminder that, for instance, the death penalty shouldn't be given for drug crimes. I'm just sort of that you have a country that's killing people who they say are drug traffickers. Thank you.
On our position on drug crimes, to be clear, people should not be killed for using trafficking, selling, possessing drugs. That is clear, and it seems like we should all be able to agree on that, but that is the clear position of the office. On the specific question, I mean, it is essential that states' responses to illicit drug trafficking respect international law, including applicable international human rights law. Countering illicit trafficking is, in principle, a law enforcement matter, and any use of force in such a context must respect the basic principles on the use of force by law enforcement officials. Under international law, to be clear, the intentional use of lethal force is only permissible as a measure of last resort against an individual representing an imminent threat to life. Any loss of life in the context of a law enforcement operation must be independently, promptly, and transparently investigated.
Thank you very much. Other questions to Ravina? I don't see any. Thank you very much, and thanks for touching so many issues and for this incredibly important report. And in fact, speaking about human rights, I just would like to remind you that on Tuesday, 9th of September at 1 p.m., this time is another independent international fact-finding mission, the one for Sudan, will brief you on their latest reports, and that will be with the chair of the fact-finding mission, Mohamed Chande Otman, and also join Gozi Ezeilo and Mona Rishmawi, the expert members of the fact-finding mission. And also human rights reminder for the Committee on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights will open next Monday at 10 a.m., its 78th session. We'll review the reports of the Russian Federation, Colombia, Chile, the Netherlands, Zimbabwe, and Lao PDR. And of course, we also know that on Monday we will all be in the Assembly Hall for the opening of the human rights session. Christian, I see you put your camera on. Do you have something for the journalist? Then I will give you my last two announcements. Thank you so much, Ramina. Christian, would you like to add something? Please go ahead.
Indeed, thank you very much. And as Ravina was mentioning all the troubles DRC is going through, let me just add what was sent around yesterday in order to highlight yet another issue, because DRC is only one of the many threats in DRC. Are the conflicts and others. Yesterday, the health authorities in the Democratic Republic of Congo have declared an outbreak of Ebola virus disease in Kasai province, where by now, so far, 28 suspected cases and 16 deaths have been reported, including four healthcare workers. A quick look at the map, I think, shows that Kasai province and the areas of M23 that Ravina was just referring to are not related, but that is just a small positive note here. WHO has deployed 12 staff on the ground at this point, with more on the way. And we're joining a rapid response teams to trace the contacts and to find the cases. And we're collecting and testing samples. And we have technical expertise. To give you an idea of the remoteness of this area, this rapid response team has left under the lead of the government on Monday. And by yesterday evening, Thursday evening, they were just 60 kilometers short of the area where they need to reach. So that's what makes, of course, everything difficult, every transport of material. So we have also already delivered or are delivering personal protective equipment, mobile laboratory equipment, medical supplies, and more. And we have luckily previously prepositioned about 2,000 doses of Ebola vaccine in Kinshasa, which was now released to vaccinate contacts and health workers. Thank you. And by the way, you could hear more this afternoon at our DG presser at 3 o'clock, which serves as an announcement on top of it now. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Christian. Thanks for this useful update. Is there any particular question on what Christian just said, or other question for Christian? I don't see any, so thanks, Christian. Let me just give you a couple of more announcements. First of all, I'm asked by the colleagues at IOM to inform you that their Director General, Emmy Pope, will attend the UN General Assembly High Level Week in New York. She will be there, I think, from what they are telling me, from 22nd to the 27th of September. And she will be available for interviews there. So if you want to have an interview with Mrs. Pope, maybe your colleagues, if you're not following directly, those of you who have colleagues who are at the UNGA, just contact Jorge Galindo. I also wanted to inform you, and this is something that, of course, we will speak more on the 9th, but just for your information and planning purposes, the 9th of September, the UN Secretary General will launch a new report on the impact of rising global military spending on the Sustainable Development Goals. This is called The Security We Need, Rebalancing Military Spending for a Sustainable and Peaceful Future. It's a direct outcome of the Pact for the Future, and it looks at how the unprecedented military spending surge in recent years is occurring as global security deteriorates and progress on the SDGs is falling short. So you will have the launch will be done in New York, but the press conference will be webcast. You will have the UN High Representative for Disarmament, Izumi Nakamitsu, and the Acting Administrator of UNDP, Hao Liang Zhu, to launch this report. And that will be, as I said, on the 9th of September, 11 o'clock New York time. So I think it's 5 o'clock here, 5 p.m. here. And it will be live streamed. We also have media contacts for this report. So if any of you, I know many of you follow the disarmament issues. So if you need to have a contact to receive the material under embargo or for any other details, don't hesitate to ask. We've also sent you several statements of the Secretary General for the various days that the international community commemorates in this moment. So today is International Day of Charity, something really important in our incredibly difficult world. But we also have on the 7th of September, International Day of Clean Air for Blue Skies, International Day of Police Cooperation, and International Literacy Day, which is under the leadership of UNESCO. And I think I have told you everything I had. So, just a very last issue. I've sent you, I think it was yesterday, an incredibly interesting opportunity for training for journalists organized by our colleagues in UNICRI. I think you have received it. Just don't hesitate to take this completely free training. Yeah, is that on this? Okay, but just go ahead. That was just, I wanted to remind you that I had sent you this, and please connect with Marina at UNICRI to participate if you wish.
Just want to know if Claire is still online.
Claire, let me see. I'll tell you in a second. No, she's not. Okay. I'm afraid. Let me see. Unless I don't see her and she's on.
Maybe you can answer.
Please open your camera. No, but I don't see her. No, I'm sorry.
Are you aware of a press conference by WMO on the 9th? It was something about artificial intelligence and weather prediction. It was on the calendar of events that you sent, but we haven't been receiving any dates or specific hour, let's say.
I have seen something with. Let me just check because it's not in my notes. Sorry, I'm just checking. Maybe I can come back to you with this. For the moment, I don't have it on my calendar, Jeremy. But we will check. We will check with Claire and come back to you. Any other question for me or colleagues? No? So thank you very much. Thanks for following the briefing. Have a nice weekend, and we see each other on Tuesday. Thank you.